Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD-HD. I'm Gregory Berg. Some of you may very well remember the name of Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, a psychotherapist with a thriving and successful practice, but someone whose name is familiar to many for a very different reason. Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, at the age of 60, gave birth to twins. And of course, you can imagine the kind of attention which this garnered from really across the country. People amazed at such a thing, that such a thing could be possible. And of course, it raised also a host of questions about whether such a thing was wise and what it sort of meant in terms of our understanding of what it means to be a mother, what it means to be 60, sort of what life is all about. All kinds of really important questions posed, which she explores now in a really interesting book called Life Begins at 60, A New View on Motherhood, Marriage, and Reinventing Ourselves, published by Skyhorse Publishing. And Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much.
I'm really happy to be speaking with you. Let's begin with kind of a sketch of kind of your basic life, of where you come from, and of how your life unspooled into early adulthood in a way that would not seem particularly out of the ordinary.
Exactly. I've always had to have some kind of stigma attached to me, or maybe in a more positive way, that I always had to take a leap forward on my own because I needed to do what was right for me. So always I had to fight for my parents, who were Jewish immigrants in this country, discrimination, and onward in my life with equality and for myself. And today it's more about age than the babies, because that's really what surprised me. I didn't know I was old until everyone told me I was so old.
Hmm.
So, you know, I sort of took a step back and said, you know, what does this all mean? So it was very interesting.
Right. Let's talk for a moment about the choice that you made when I think you were in your late 20s at the time, if I remember correctly. By this point, you are married. You're the mother of two wonderful children. And yet you felt something that a fair number of people will feel at various points in their lives. You felt a certain sense of incompleteness. And at that point, you went back to school, got your PhD in psychology, and of course became a psychotherapist. Just speak for a moment about what sort of hunger or dissatisfaction you felt at that point, and just how difficult it was then to act upon those feelings and write a new chapter for yourself.
Well, yeah, that's a very important question, because at that time you didn't do both. You were either a mother or you had a career. Being a psychologist was something that mostly men did. Psychoanalyst was a man's field. So even at that time, I was told, you know, oh, you're going to work. I would never do something like that. And I had to question whether I was a good mother or not. So there was a lot of pressure on me to make that decision of having to look at what I needed to do and the right thing for my children. I later found out that kids who have parents, both parents who work, are more confident. But at that time, I didn't get that kind of support. And it was a very difficult thing to find out that it was okay. But much later, and it would have been way too late for me to try to get the right kind of approval because I would not be true to myself. So I had to be true to myself over what society dictated me to do. And even Gloria Steinem has said that she's sorry she didn't do both, have children and having this movement towards women's rights and being involved in that area.
As we sort of read through the main framework of how your life has gone, we see you going back to school, getting your PhD, becoming a psychotherapist, and then much later, at the age of 53, well, I think your feelings occurred a little bit before that, but you have this sense that, again, something is missing, that you want something else. You want once again to have the experience of giving birth to a child, well past the age when it is at least customary to do so. I'm just curious, before those feelings became so intense that you felt compelled, you and your husband, to act upon them, did you feel that sort of deep within you all along? Was there at least a little bit of that hunger, or did that sort of well up in your late 40s? And if so, for what particular reason do you think?
That's an excellent question, and I've always felt that what society told me to do didn't really fit quite right. And I found out later in my research that other women felt the same way. Yes, I had children when I was 26 and 30. And it was the right thing to do. And at my time, people would ask me, aren't you going to have a child? But I was putting my husband through law school, and I had to hold up on having any children so I could work to help him financially through school. But I didn't have an urge to have children at that time either. But society told me that there's something wrong with me if I didn't. Being a young woman at the time, I went along with those pressures, but instinctually, I really wanted to have children later. And in my 40s is when I had the desire to have a child. And that desire went on till I did have a child at the age of 53.
You are still married to your husband, have been married for 40 years now, and of course, this journey was not just yours alone, but his as well. I'm just curious if you could just say a word about particularly this first time that the urge for motherhood returned to you when you were in your late 40s. How did you broach this topic with your husband? And how did he greet this possibility? And to what extent did it need to be a journey that the two of you took together?
Well, I do remember that at first he said, are you kidding me? You know, you're finally going to have it easy, and you've done it already, and you've gone through school. Now you can enjoy your life. You have a practice. The kids are older. So he questioned it. But then he saw that I wasn't too old. And to be honest with you, I never told the truth about my age. And I looked younger, so that wasn't difficult. I figure, who cares? You know, my parents lived on in their years, and who's to know? And this is what I think I can contribute in a way that would be beneficial to everybody. So at that time, I had much more of an urge than when I was younger because I felt more equipped to be supportive and nurturing. Because I already had my degree, I already had my practice, I already knew who I was. When I was younger, I didn't have all that. And you know, your brain doesn't develop till you're 26 anyway, fully. So I really was not somebody who was determined to have children and then children and then children my whole life. I did not, you know, the maternity ward doesn't define me. But it just so happened that the real instinctual feelings came in later. So I would have reversed it, and I think that's where we're going more now, with a career, educating myself in the beginning, feeling established, having an identity, and not through my husband, because I did resent him going to work and having his imaging career while I was taking care of my children that I love dearly and was fortunate to have such wonderful children. So that was that conflict, you know, back and forth. So the times would have been better to have children later, and women are having their children later today. In school, there are a lot of parents, I don't know if the right word is middle-aged, but they're in their 40s, and their children are in kindergarten. So times have changed, but at that time, it was not supported.
We're speaking with Dr. Frieda Birnbaum, the author of a book called Life Begins at 60. So not only did you decide then to have a third child when you were 53 through in vitro fertilization, but then, amazingly, at the age of 60, you end up giving birth to twin boys. I remember you saying at some point, I think in an interview, that you think there was something about the number six, the digit of six, that really sort of triggered something in people that and might be at least part of the reason why there was such widespread dismay and concern over this choice that you were making. I'm curious. I mean, I think I can understand the public's dismay and so on. I wonder if you could speak to what the reaction was to this amongst people closer to you. Again, your own husband, your older children, your closest friends. How did they greet this surprising possibility that you would again give birth at the age of 60? How did they receive this?
It was wild. I mean, it was crazy. They had to hire a switchboard operator just for me in the hospital. There was a guard waiting at my door. Like, who knows what I did? And he walked everywhere that I went. People were calling me from around the world. There were on YouTube or wherever it was, a million or so people talking about it. And it was just interesting that the ones in their 30s were outraged. How dare I do something like that that's meant for the younger generation? And then women in their 50s calling me and thanking me from around the world. I mean, Dubai, Africa, Germany, I mean, you name it, thanking me that I gave them the permission not to have another child, but to be have passion and to be energetic and vital and youthful when they felt that way without having to hide it. So that's the one thing that did make me feel a sense of accomplishment, not having the children so much, but really identifying what 60 is today. And I didn't know I was old till everyone told me I was old.
So in other words, you physically,
that old lady.
Right, you physically did not feel all that old.
No,
and I know you have said again and again that you feel more energetic as a mother now than you did back in your 20s.
Yeah, I know myself. I know what's important to me. I don't feel more tired. I feel less tired because I'm satisfied and contented with my own identity. So, you know, it's something that society is really pinpointing numbers that have nothing to do with today and what today means. You know, I had somebody ringing my doorbell, and I opened the door, and he came from Germany, a journalist from Germany, and said to me, "Where's the old lady?" And I said to him, "I guess I'm the old lady." And that's how they see, you know, that number. But it's not something that is really relevant anymore. I mean, women are at the gym. They're not in rocking chairs knitting little booties anymore. When do you see that? Or with pink hair? I mean, my hair is blonde, and it's the way it was before. Am I sinning? Am I doing something I'm not allowed to do? I mean, did I sign up for having to be a certain way? I don't think so.
One thing that ended up happening is that in order to pursue this, you and your husband ended up leaving the country. And ultimately, I think the in vitro fertilization procedure was done in South Africa, where evidently this tends to be carried out with a little less exacting gauntlet of qualifications and questions and so on. What kind of efforts did you make to have this done here? I mean, did you attempt it? Did you contact fertility clinics? And were you told no, flat out, because of your age? I mean, how difficult was it to try to get this last effort launched?
Well, that's interesting, because I was just a few months over the age of 55, and that's the cutoff age that they did have here. But, you know, the way it started was that we were on a cruise, and the cruise did not go so well. There were waves over the ship, and we were in our cabins for 3 days, and I had nothing to do but read some magazines. That's what got us in trouble. And they said, hey, Africa, cheaper, older mothers. And since I never told the truth about my age and the fact that we were going to adopt, I just sort of, you know, tucked it away and looked at it and forgot about it. And the interesting story is that we heard that Donald Trump wanted the ship back for a photo shoot for something, commercial or whatever. So this captain really almost killed all of us trying to get back through storms. But the interesting part about it is that I tell people, this is a far stretch, that I got a bump because of the Donald, because I was in the cabin reading this magazine, and I got bumped off the Oprah show because of the Donald, because I was going on, and he changed his mind. It was in May. It was the end of her interviews. So, you know, and he was on her show with a baby at the age of 60-something, and he had a child at 60, but he's a man, so I guess that was not a problem, or it still is not a problem. And, you know, so that's some of my experience with, I forgot your question. But
I was just wondering about, I mean, you ultimately had it done in South Africa. I wondered how difficult it was and how extensively you and your husband attempted to have this procedure done here in the United States.
Well, you know, they had to almost close down the clinic because of me, because they got a flood of calls, and they were threatened to close down. So the government asked not even to speak about it, and it shows that a lot of older women want to have children. So that's something that, you know, I didn't really have difficulty with, and if I would have waited and tried and attempted just a few months older than the cutoff date, I would have been fine here. But it took from the mid-50s to 60. I didn't start saying, I'm 60, I think I want to have a child. That's not what happened. I started much earlier, and I had a child when I was 53, and I wanted to have a sibling for my son. It was like an only child here, so I do make some sense. And I think I'm not completely off the wall, just a little bit. So what happened was that the process took a while, and, you know, life takes over. My father got sick, and I had to take care of him. So there were several adjustments that I had to take along the road before I got to that point.
By the way, if this had not ended up being medically possible, that is, if this in vitro fertilization had not, in fact, been successful, do you ever wonder about the option of adoption? If you would have gone ahead and adopted a child instead, or if this longing that you felt was about more than just being a mother to a child, but was a longing to give birth? Is that what this was more about?
Well, guess what? None of that is true. It wasn't me who wanted another to deliver a child. I did it already, and I didn't have a longing to give birth at all. It wasn't a natural, instinctual feeling. At that point, we had our fingerprints taken. We had a social worker here. We're going through the adoption process, and even our social worker said she adopted and did not have good experiences. So because of that, my husband, no one ever mentions him, ever. But surprise, he's the one, not me. He's never had an interview on this. And he's older than me, not to scare you. But, yeah, he's the one. that said, try it. You look younger. Nobody knows your age. There's longevity. Just, you know, try it. If it doesn't work, we'll have had a vacation in Africa, which we had a wonderful time. We went on helicopter rides, which I would not recommend because it's like sitting in a flat metal thing with everything open. Pretty scary, but we went on cable cars. We went to a safari, which we had a blast, trip of a lifetime. And, you know, not knowing if this would happen, but then coming back with some operator saying that I called it up and I was pregnant.
I know that one of the people that reacted most strongly to the news and to the arrival then of these twin boys was your oldest son, and his bewilderment or anger or hurt or whatever it was he was feeling at that time was serious enough that I know at least a couple of years went by, years, before he could, in a sense, bring himself to even see these baby twin brothers. Could you just say a word about his reaction and how painful that was to you, and to what extent that had an impact on the joy that otherwise you and your husband were feeling about all this?
Well, it was very painful, and I went to as far as when my twins would see my oldest son coming, they would run upstairs automatically, not knowing that this was a wrong thing to do for them, that it wasn't fair, but they were just so adjusted to it. So they'd say, oh, he's coming, we better run upstairs, and they would look out their windows, and it was very painful for me. But, you know, I didn't want to upset my oldest son either. And we even had a holiday celebration. I think it was Passover, and we were downstairs, and I was downstairs with my son and his wife while my twins were upstairs. And at that point, I really said, this is ridiculous, and it was 3 years. And one day, my oldest son was in the kitchen, and they happened to run in. And they said, oh, we're so sorry, and they ran upstairs. That's how innocent they were. And then when he saw them, he says, you know, Ma, I felt bad about it, and I feel so good that this happened. Let's forget about it. But you're right, you know, in the beginning, it was almost as if he felt that this was something that I shouldn't be doing. It's the wrong time in my life. But when you're 30 and you look at somebody 60, they're ancient. And the real message is that women especially shouldn't fear that getting older is ancient. If anything, it's a better time. You have a whole package. And even though it upset him, it did give him a message that to be who you are in a way that makes sense and to do what's right for you is most important. I did not get in his way with his life, with his children. His children not come and play with my children, and they're the best of friends. So you really have to persevere in life and break barriers to get to the other side, and you'll be much better off.
You spend some time in your book talking about vocabulary and the fact that you, I think, not only regret the way we think about age and what is appropriate for various people of various ages, but you really don't like the way we often frame our thoughts and express our thoughts in terms of vocabulary, terminology. How would you have us talk about the reality of age?
Well, the reality is that midlife is not negative. Midlife crisis can happen at any time. And when you're talking about middle age, that signifies something almost as if, okay, you're middle age and now the next step is over the hill. That's what's waiting for you. And it's not true. The next step is going ahead and reinventing yourself because you know who you are already and making choices that life can be a dress rehearsal. To have two careers because we're living longer, younger, and the second time around, hey, maybe you'll do something that really identifies who you are, that you can have failure, without feeling desperate that this is your only chance. So, you know, instead of middle age, we should have peak age, because it's the best of times, and we should be excited and celebrate the future rather than be apprehensive or fearful, because every decade of our life we keep looking at it as this, ugh, you're old. It's not the case. And you have to break that. I was told every decade of my life that I was old. 30, it was time to who knows what. I was middle-aged when I was in my 30s, but I got a degree from Columbia in psychology from my master's. 40 over the hill, but I got my PhD in my mid-40s. 50, I'm no longer a spring chicken. I delivered a beautiful baby boy. And 60, the world told me I was old. So it's, I have got no break. What can I tell you? You know, when is it my, when am I going to finally be young? Anytime? I said, you know what, the hell with it.
Right.
I'm not waiting anymore.
Mm.
So when my son said, it's his turn, I said, oh, yeah?
Mm.
You know, I've done that, been there.
A last question.
Yeah.
So you are busy, you and your husband, parenting young twins, twin boys who are, I should think, what, 8 or 9 years old or going on 10, something like that?
9 years old.
Do you ever wish at this point that you were grandparenting them rather than parenting them? I only mean that in the sense that, you know, grandparents, that's the fun job. You know, you're the one that gets to, you know, feed them candy and this and that. But generally speaking, the grandparents get to, you know, drop them off at the end. And it's the parents who deal with the stuff that's not so fun. I mean, parenting is a huge responsibility. But does it feel like it is a responsibility that you were wise to take on yourselves again at this point in your lives? Does it feel
right? It's a
very
joyful experience. I'm very fortunate. I have two boys that are very energetic. They have a lust for life. And whatever they do, they're happy and excited about. So it's very, very comforting to know that they're going in a wonderful direction. And no, at the end of the day, I don't want to give them to somebody else. And I do have grandchildren, and it's a whole different kind of relationship. They're not my children. They're my son's children. And I have joy, and I'm proud of them and supportive of them. And we have fun together. But it's a different kind of relationship. So with my children, you know, is there a time that I've had enough? Of course. Is there a time they want to kill each other off? Yeah. And I have to get in there and scream a little bit so I can't talk anymore. Of course, you know, that happens pretty often, because one of them likes to tease the other one, and then the other one goes after him, and it's, I can't get in between them anyway. What's the difference? So these things happen, and now they're changing. I'm in the car, and one wants to go bowling and one wants to go to a movie. Before, they just both said yes. And I, you know, and I said, what? You want to do this? You want to do that? Now, how do I get to that point? So, you know, there are always ways to look at things differently. And in the end, at night, when they want to stay up and they want to watch TV, and I've had it, yeah, I wish I could just go in the other room and say, okay, goodbye, it's over, time's up. But that doesn't happen. And, you know, and again, this sounds a little bit mysterious, but the appreciation when you're older is just something that I personally experienced in a way that I was blessed to have my older children, but I thought it was coming to me. Now I see that that's not true. It's not true that you have opportunities in life that you don't necessarily always have that. And so I feel fortunate every day that my children are doing well. They have a wonderful future. They're in camp now. They go on camping trips every other day, swimming. You know, they just are an inspiration. And me, I want to be able to give them everything so they can grow in the healthiest way possible. And I should live a long life and to be there for them. And that's what gives me a lot of pride.
The book is Life Begins at 60, A New View on Motherhood, Marriage, and Reinventing Ourselves, published by Sky Horse Publishing, the author, Dr. Frieda Birnbaum. Dr. Birnbaum, it's been a great pleasure for me to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Be well. Take care. Bye-bye.
Yesterday in the mail, I received a book that I have been looking forward to with great interest, a book called Love and Miscommunication, but that's two words, miss, M-I-S-S, communication, love and miscommunication. And it is a new novel by Alyssa Friedland. And what I have read of this book is absolutely wonderful. It's a book I just could not put down. Alyssa Friedland's novel tells the story of a young lawyer by the name of Evie Rosen. She is in her early 30s and finds herself tied up in a very, very challenging job at a law firm in New York City and living a life which probably a lot of young professionals can relate to, in which she is pretty much tied to her BlackBerry morning, noon, and night. And then something happens which very much disrupts her professional life and also ends up disrupting this whole notion she has of how it is that she can remain connected with everybody around her in the outside world. And she ultimately ends up learning a whole lot about herself through this painful process. It's a really, really thought-provoking and timely novel. It's written by Alyssa Friedland, who is a graduate of Columbia Law School and worked for a time as an associate at a major law firm. Her fine writing has appeared in a lot of different places, and we will be asking her about how much the life of Evie Rosen reflects her own. This novel is published by William Morrow, an imprint of HarperCollins. Alyssa Friedland, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be speaking to you. And I'm excited. It's my publication day. Big day for me.
All right. Well, I'm glad we can be part of the excitement today. I really have enjoyed this novel thoroughly. Let's start with that basic question, and it's probably one you better get used to hearing, because I suspect a lot of people are going to ask you the same question.
Sure.
This character of Evie Rosen bears what appears to be some very significant similarities to your own life. Tell us more about the similarities and then maybe about a few differences.
Sure. Okay. Well, absolutely. I think there are similarities between myself and the protagonist. We have the same schooling. I also live in New York City. I was an attorney and worked at a high-powered firm and lived the crazy life of being connected professionally. I'm still connected all the time, but now it's more socially. At the time, I really had to take my BlackBerry into the bathroom with me. I had to sleep with it under my pillow. I always felt the challenge and the pull of my job and constantly being connected. And that was just professionally. And then there were the social things. You know, before I was, now I'm married and I have three children, but when I was dating, there was the pull of always feeling like I needed to be connected to meet somebody and researching people I met and seeing whether I should go out with them or not. It was crazy. And I'm still very connected, although the process of writing this book has helped me come to terms with what I think really was a true internet addiction that I had and that I think so many people have. And it takes away from the quality of their lives, and it certainly took away from the quality of my life. And the reason I wrote the book, I was inspired. I went to Yale, and when I went to my five-year college reunion, it was the weirdest thing. We didn't even know, should we ask each other, where do you live? What are you up to? Because we all knew everything about each other from Facebook. And I went away from that weekend experience feeling like, wow, our lives are completely different. And reunions aren't what they used to be, and friendships aren't what they used to be. And I got the idea for the novel about a woman who gives up the internet for a year and sees where life takes her.
You are echoing an experience I just had yesterday. I called an older woman from back home in my hometown who has at times been kind of a surrogate mom to me. I lost my mom many years ago, and called up this woman. And at some point in our conversation, I asked her a couple of questions about people I'd lost track of. And she started to tell me, and this is just something she's so good at sharing gossip. And she kind of stopped herself almost right away and said, but I bet you know all this from Facebook.
Right, sure.
And I realized, I mean, in this particular case, it happened not to be true, but in most cases, yes. And and something like picking up the phone and calling Jude, because she could sort of tell you the scoop on just about anybody you were interested in. For her, the world is completely different now, and in a sense, her function in it is altered dramatically by the fact that our lives are such open books, at least those of us who participate in things like Facebook.
I definitely have that. I mean, my mom's not that technologically savvy, and she will call me sometimes to tell me a big juicy piece of gossip from home, and it's I've often known for weeks already because of Facebook. I mean, there's very little, actually, that she tells me that I don't already know. But what I think is really the most interesting piece is that what we know from Facebook and Instagram and Twitter is really just what people are choosing to share. It's a very curated version of our lives, and I think that's the element that's the most destructive.
Mm. And, of course, when you start talking about matters of, for instance, dating, that also ultimately makes it a really scary thing, because each and every person you meet, you are wondering what is hidden beneath that carefully curated surface.
Absolutely. And then there's also just learning too much too soon. I just wrote a piece for our website called Bustle about how the internet is ruining people's love lives. And I learned so many interesting things. I mean, first of all, everybody said that when they go on a date now, both people have their smartphone on the table the entire time. And it's actually considered perfectly acceptable to check it, you know, every 5 minutes. That's normal. And that was really upsetting to me, because things like eye contact and body language, I mean, these are important things. But also what they're learning about someone, and this happens in my book, in Love and Miscommunication. I mean, once she gives up the internet, she learns things about the people in her world in an organic fashion, and it's very different than, and her reactions are different than had she internet stalked them and looked them up right away and learned information about them before she even got to know them, and she's just judging them very differently. I think you go on a date with someone and you say, oh, look, but I looked online and it shows he has 2 children already. You know, well, maybe that would be okay with you if you learned that on date number 4 and you already like the person, but going into date 1, you might say, oh, I'm not interested. You know, you're learning too much too soon. Hmm. There's just too much information available.
Right. I also thought it was there's an interesting moment early in the novel where she is going on a date with someone. I mean, it's essentially a blind date, or they've been set up with friends or something, but she ends up inadvertently revealing that she had Googled him.
Oh, yeah.
I think because she had, you know,
that's one of my favorite parts of the book.
Yeah, so she'd Googled his name and things came up, but it was actually somebody else of the same name who maybe went to the same school. I forget what the source of confusion was, but he very quickly figured out, aha, you've Googled me. And
yes,
he seemed genuinely upset by that.
Yes, yes. And it's interesting. I mean, I think we're sort of in a place right now where, of course, it's assumed that you Google everybody you're about to go out with and you're about to meet, but you're not quite at the place where you should be readily admitting it yet. And I bet in a year from now, it'll be, you know, it, like, just completely normal to say, well, of course I looked you up. But right now, I think we're sort of at the cusp where we know everybody's looking, but it's still a bit uncool to admit that you checked the person out. And that actually, I'll never forget, I was interested in somebody, before I got married. I was interested, and I wanted to look him up on Facebook. And I made such a stupid mistake. And instead of putting the name in my search part of Facebook, I put it as my status update.
Mm.
So the guy's name was just there in my post. I mean, it was mortifying, and that really, of course, inspired that moment in Love and Miscommunication for Evie, just these internet blunders that people are making.
Well, right. I mean, and it can have devastating consequences. We sort of see that as well. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Alyssa Friedland, and we're talking about her brand-new novel called Love and Miscommunication, in which the character, I guess you're calling her Evie, I called
Evie.
Her Evie. Evie Rosen is a young lawyer in New York City, I mean, in her early 30s. To many of us, that seems young. Actually, to her, she feels to some extent like life is passing her by, in the sense that she is in this high-stress professional position with a law firm, and at the same time really spinning her wheels romantically, and doesn't necessarily even know what to do about that. One of the ways in which you really open us up to this side of her life is when you have her in a phone conversation very early on with her beloved grandmother, who has absolutely no hesitation in meddling in her granddaughter's life. I wonder if you would just say a word about this character and the function she serves in this novel.
I love the grandmother. She is, if, you know, you shouldn't have favorites, but she's my favorite character in the book. I mean, she's so blunt. I mean, there's a line in the book. I mean, all she wants is her granddaughter to get married and be settled. And she's very old-fashioned. And it's funny, but I have people like this in my family. I mean, even my own mother would. I said, "Mom, I got into Yale." And she'd say, "I hope you meet somebody there." So you know, the grandmother is a little bit based on her and my own grandmother. And she's totally befuddled by technology as well. And I mean, there's a great moment in the book where the grandmother calls up Evie and says, "I found out you can meet somebody online. You should sign up for this." And Evie says, "I've known about this for like 10 years already, you know."
Well, and it's led to nothing but disaster.
And it's led to nothing but disaster, exactly. So I adore the grandmother. I think she has a tremendous amount of wisdom. And I'm not an old-fashioned person. I'm a professional working mom. But I think there is some wisdom in what the grandmother says, that you can have all the professional success in the world, but if you're lonely, your happiness is definitely going to be limited.
Right. One of the things I really appreciate about the book is the picture you paint of Evie Rosen's professional life, or at least early on before things go rather drastically wrong, but what life is like for a young associate at a rather prestigious law firm. And it helps us understand that we might see somebody at a distance and see them as entirely put together and not really understand that just beneath the surface is someone who is scrambling desperately, frantically, to keep up with all that is confronting them in just about the most high-pressure, high-stakes occupation that there is. Say more about that reality and maybe what it was like for you to, in a sense, relive some of that stress as you wrote this novel.
I actually worked at one of the best law firms in America, based in New York City, and everybody I worked with was wonderful. So in a sense, I had a very positive experience, and I really liked my colleagues, and I really liked my bosses. That said, there was just a tremendous amount of pressure. The numbers were just so big. I mean, you're merging multi-billion dollar companies. It's a big, big deal. And in New York, I just feel like nobody sleeps, and you're expected to be on call 24/7. And it's very hard, and you're definitely checking your BlackBerry when you're in the movies, and you're checking your BlackBerry at every red light and checking it while you're crossing the street. And it takes away from life. And I left my job after I had my second child because I really just couldn't manage the hours anymore. And I think it's true that there's so much pressure in a place like where I worked and all these law firms to appear like you have it all together, like it's perfectly normal and fine to stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning working and then look presentable the next day and put a smile on your face, when just beneath the surface, I think almost everybody is a bit shaky and a kind of unraveling a bit.
Right. I appreciate at one point you have Evie thinking to herself, there was a certain thrill in racing to meet the deadline. I mean, I think you know, many people from the outside looking in might, if they even knew the details of someone's life, such a life, would think, why in the world would somebody willingly place themselves in that kind of situation where there are deadlines that you might or might not meet, and who would willingly take on such stress in their lives? And yet, that in and of itself can be a very powerful source of addiction, I should think.
Absolutely. I think it's almost like the internet addiction. I mean, it's an adrenaline rush when you're working, especially when you're surrounded by a lot of people. And I've had a major career transition going from a corporate law firm to being a writer. It's very solitary. I'm definitely happier as a writer, and I think my book has a very strong message about social media and the internet, and I'm proud of it. But there are times, like Evie, that I do miss my job. I miss the excitement from being in an office with so many people all working towards a common goal, and there are funny moments at 2 o'clock in the morning when you start having crust around your eyes and you're texting your significant other that you're still not going to be home. And there's just a certain camaraderie that is I could never replicate as a writer. I mean, writers are a very welcoming community, but we all work by ourselves in coffee shops in our sweatpants. You know, it's a totally different life. And I think Evie was a bit addicted to the adrenaline rush, and she's very much a pleaser, and she's very much interested in climbing the ladder and reaching the next achievement, which is a trait that I find many people have. You know, you just, especially now with social media, and you just want, it's competition. You want to get the most likes. You want to have the most exciting thing to report in your post. And she's very caught up in that world, and she is attracted to her job because of the prestige.
It's interesting, too, at one point when you say that her work could be very stimulating, Evie thinks to herself, but with each new project that landed on her desk, she still felt like an anxious freshman, unsure if she was up to the task. When I read those words, it really helped me understand how somebody like that, in a position like that, might really turn to something like Facebook for validation and for a sense of connectedness to one's friends. Because if you feel that level of vulnerability in the work that you do each and every day, it makes even more sense then for you to sort of need this other thing, even if it ultimately maybe isn't the best thing to turn to for that.
Absolutely. And I think that during the work day, it's when you're kind of confined to your office and you know you're going to be there all day, and then you have the outlet of Facebook to be able to see what's going on with your friends. It's calming. It's a distraction. I mean, I think ultimately Evie was a bit bored by her work. I mean, she was caught up in the excitement of the office and knowing she was, you know, working on deals that would be in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, but the actual work that she was doing bored her at times, and she had Facebook as an outlet to entertain her during the day. It's what gets her into trouble in the end. I mean, without giving away any spoilers, you know, her career, her love life, they all sort of topple over all because of the internet. And she basically is a woman who is on the cusp of major life changes, major breakdown, and much of it caused by her internet addiction. She's under a lot of pressure, and I think her transition throughout the book is a very interesting journey.
Right. And, of course, it's one not without some bumps, and I think you are careful not to paint too simplistic a picture of, if only people would unplug their phones, life would be so much better or life would be so much easier. I mean, there's something very positive to be said about that disconnection, but I think you are trying to tell a story here that remains very realistic.
Thank you. It's much more nuanced than that, and I don't think that people can realistically disconnect. It's not possible. I mean, unless you have a very isolated life, I think it's hard, but I think everything in moderation. It sounds cliche, but it's like a diet, and I've taken personal steps. I leave my phone in another room while I eat. I try my best to not have my phone around all the time when I'm with my children, because the more you use it, the more addicted you become, and looking at Instagram every 5 minutes to see a new picture, I think it's really taken away from the quality of my life. And so many people that I've spoken to, the book has really touched them. A lot of my early readers who received the advanced copy, you know, contacted me and said, I saw myself in this main character. I'm constantly looking for a fix. It's like a drug. And they said that they kind of worked on reducing their internet dependence after the book, which made me so happy. Again, my goal, like, I'm not on a stage telling people to disconnect permanently, but I think, you know, going on Facebook once a day is reasonable. I think going on once every 10 minutes is crazy.
You give us a lot to think about in this novel, and what better compliment could there be? The novel is Love and Miscommunication. It's a paperback novel from William Morrow and the author Alyssa Friedland. Alyssa Friedland, my compliments to you on a really fine novel. I appreciate the opportunity to read it and to speak with you about it.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you, and good morning to everybody out there. I hope you enjoy the book.
It's 8:59 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I welcome into our studios two faculty colleagues from the Political Science Department at Carthage College, Jerry Mast and Jeff Roberg, who will offer their analysis of the dramatic events of the by then recently completed Republican National Convention. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andreas, a Canadian.